McEntee says AFSCME is pleased that the Senate version of the bill retains much of the funding to help struggling states maintain vital public services. The Senate and House must now reconcile their versions to get the Economic Recovery Act on the president's desk and signed into law. 10,000 is the number of the day in the world of layoffs, Jesse Russell reports.
As many as 10,000 California state workers could be laid off as soon as the end of this week. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger said he would start the layoffs on Friday if a budget deal to mend the state's $42 billion deficit isn't passed by the state legislature. The layoffs would impact mostly workers with lesser seniority, and some workers would be moved into other state positions. Friday is also the first forced day off for state workers required by the governor. Also threatening to shed 10,000 more positions is U.S. automaker GM. The company plans to present a viability plan to the U.S. government next week in an attempt to qualify for federal loans. The job cuts would be global, with 3,400 workers being cut in the U.S. Workers will also see a pay cut of between 3% and 7%, while executives will have their pay slashed by 10%.
It's really showed me that I could do a lot of things that I didn't know that I could do before. It gave me the chance to earn a lot more money.
Marge Keller is a graduate of Non-Traditional Employment for Women, a program in New York City that helps women get into construction trades. She had no union trades background before, but is now in IBEW Local 3.
I did think that unions were a good thing, that workers could organize to get good pay and good benefits.
Even the world's largest discount retailer isn't safe from recession woes. Walmart plans to cut 700 to 800 jobs at its home offices in Bentonville, Arkansas. Those job cuts will impact employees at both Walmart and Sam's Club divisions. More than 14,000 are employed by Walmart in that southern city. WINS Labor News is now available right on your cell phone. Just dial 425-527-7001. Get your WINS Labor News on your cell phone at 425-527-7001. You've been listening to WINS, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, February 11, 2009. A Palestinian man from Gaza dies of wounds sustained earlier while Israeli army invasions are reported in the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian man from the Gaza Strip was reported dead on an Egyptian hospital on Wednesday. Fayez Shamia, 23, from Gaza City, had been moved to Egypt last week after sustaining severe wounds in the head during the Israeli operation Cast Lead. According to the Palestinian embassy in Cairo, Shamia is the 33rd Palestinian to die in Egypt after sustaining wounds in the latest Israeli attacks. Also in the Strip, a Palestinian official announced that the Israeli military declared that three crossings in Gaza will be opened on Wednesday. Raed Fattouh, the head of the crossing committee, announced that the Israeli military will open Karim Abu Salem, Karim Shalom, Al-Mintar, Karen A, and Nahal Oz, which is a crossing for fuel. He added that the Israelis will allow 70 trucks of food to enter via Al-Mintar, one truck via Karni, Abu Salem, and a small amount of industrial fuel to enter via Nahal Oz. The Israeli military has closed down all crossings leading in and out of Gaza since June 2007, but has allowed a small amount of aid and fuel supplies to enter. Yesterday, all crossings were shut down completely because of the Israeli elections. In the West Bank, Israeli invasions were reported in several towns and villages. Palestinian sources reported that at least 5 civilians were kidnapped by the military during today's attacks. Israeli sources reported on Wednesday at dawn that with 99% of the votes counted, the Kadima party is still leading the race after winning 28 out of the 120 Knesset seats. The rival Likud party is only one seat behind, while the Labour party representation dropped to 13 seats. The extremist right-wing party of Avigdor Lieberman is expected to control 15 Knesset seats, and thus is expected to have a bigger influence on the creation of any coalition. Lieberman's party does not recognize the right of Arabs and Palestinians and has repeatedly called for the deportation of Arab Israelis to nearby Arab countries. Even if Livni is officially declared the winner, she must be able...
Good afternoon, and welcome to Cosmos and Cruzmos. We'll be with you from 3 until 5 this afternoon. And as always, this is Janaea, and we're going to be tickling the belly of the beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz. And from 3 to 4, we're fortunate to have Glenn Chase with us. and he is a professor of systems management, specializing in environmental economics and statistics. He's actually served as an associate professor, teaching graduate-level courses in systems management at USC for 8 years, and he's taught in multiple universities in the Central Coast, including the Naval Postgraduate School, the Monterey Institute of International Studies in Cal State University, Monterey Bay. He's also a management consultant, and he's going to be talking with us in detail about the fraud and deception used by the California Department of Food and Agriculture to poison our air last the fall of 2007. I don't know if you remember the aerial spraying, but they've lulled us into a false sense of security where we think that we're safe. We're not, and Glenn is here to explain that to you in great detail. And then we're going to be speaking between 4 and 5. We're going to be learning about a large indigenous gathering of elders. They're going to be sharing ceremony and ancient wisdom, and that's going to be with Adam Yellowbird and Asher Lyons. So stay with us, and I'm going to start with Glenn here, and also Alan is here, Alan Fisher. He's going to be co-hosting with me, but I want to introduce you to Glenn, and thank you for coming here, Glenn.
Thank you, Janae. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's great to be on your show.
Thank you.
If you'd like me to start, I'd like to suggest to the listeners that they get a pen and a paper so that some things that you mention or that we talk about during the show, they might want to take a couple of notes for references to follow up. The name of the report is specifically Fraud and Deception, the CDFA LBAMI Eradication Program, a detailed description of management strategy fraud. Now, the report identifies the actual CDFA management strategy fraud and deception and the details of the fraud and deception that CDFA used and continues to use to this day. Your listeners can find the report by Googling the letters, the four letters, CDFA. That's C as in California, mm-hmm. D as in department, mm-hmm. F as in food, and A as in agriculture. And, of course, CDFA, it means California Department of Food and Agriculture.
Great. And can you start with a little history as to how they got started and why they're even interested in salting us with these toxic chemicals?
Well, I can tell you some information. I won't give the ultimate conclusion to that question. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that if they are able to perpetrate this program on the people, they will receive $500 million of taxpayer funds over 5 years. So I'll let the listeners make their own conclusions. I can talk about the five methods of fraud that mm-hmm. specifically they are using within their management system. The first one is we call fear and solution. And the example is that is they create the fear that this moth is a devastating pest that's going to eat all of our agricultural crops, it's going to devastate our natural forest, and even come in and take over our backyard gardens. So that's the fear. The solution is, of course, they have the solution. They'll take $500 million and take care of it for us. Now, the simplest symbolic way I can talk about how other people have represented this is it would be exactly the same as taking the money to keep the sky from falling. Now, obviously, most people aren't familiar with a light brown apple moth. Most people aren't familiar with insects of any kind mm-hmm. to this extent. Mm-hmm. So if we weren't familiar that the sky wasn't really going to fall and someone offered to keep it from falling on us, we might say thank you very much and let them take our money. But that's the situation here.
It's a good example. What is the truth of the light brown apple moth? Is it dangerous? Where did it come from? How long has it been here?
Okay. Well, the argument has gone back and forth for some time as we first learned about it, but I think the simplest way and the best way to focus is now that we've had over four dozen communications with mostly New Zealand, where the moth came from, and other countries where the moth lived, we haven't found a single farmer, a single scientist, anyone that's familiar with the moth that has been able to identify that it is dangerous. In fact, just the contrary. It's even difficult to get a person from New Zealand to talk about the moth's danger, just as it would be difficult to get one of us to talk about the danger of a ladybug. It's that extreme, And, of course, you know, it's taken us up to about a year now to finally realize this wasn't just a difference of opinion. It was a total intentional misconception. So the moth is not dangerous. And think of another thing. If it were dangerous, we would have an example or a sample of some damage that this moth did somewhere in the world, sometime during recorded history, and there is no such example.
Glenn, I was looking, I was doing a little bit of research the other night, and I saw photos on the CDFA webpage of the destruction that the LBAM apparently had caused. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, that's really interesting. In fact, they showed those same photographs to a number of cities and counties in this Bay Area. And initially, many cities and counties felt, as you did when you saw those pictures, like, oh boy, we better do something about this. Fortunately, a good number of scientists followed the CDFA management into these same cities and gave them the true information. In fact, people have asked now for these pictures. They've asked for the dates of these pictures, and they've asked for the locations of these pictures to get official documentation, and the CDFA will not produce them after multiple requests. So
if
the viewers want to take a look at those pictures, you'll notice they're not at all in agricultural settings. They seem to be set up. In other words, anyone can take a piece of fruit, break it open themselves, and force any insect larva into the fruit. And if the CDFA had been legitimate, they certainly would have released the pictures with the dates and location. They simply will not do it.
Wow. I didn't realize that. They just looked real to me. I had no idea. And you had outlined in your report 5 specific methods. And if you could share a little bit more. The first one was fear and solution, and then the second method was supplying other agencies with false information. Can you give?
That's right. There's other state agencies that actually do reports and analysis, and what we found is that the CDFA has given these state agencies false information, so when they use this information, they then come up with mostly innocently, you know, and trusting that this CDFA is a state agency and would have given them the correct information, they do their analysis, and then they come up with the results that CDFA had wanted them to. As an example, the CDFA gave the Department of Pesticide Regulation, which we abbreviate as DPR, and the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, OEHHA, the information that the particle size within this spray was greater than 25 microns. All the particles were greater than 25 microns. Now let me explain why this is important. Particles less than 10 microns in size, no matter what they are, even if they're totally safe, the material, if the particle is that small, it can go into a person's body and literally cause death. It can interfere with organs, it can interrupt reproduction capability, it can stop child development. And to give you a visual example, if you've ever walked into a high-tech electronics firm with an air blower so that when you walk in, no dust particles come into the room, and sometimes they even have you remove your shoes, it would be similar to walking into one of those rooms and throwing dust and sand into the air. Now, what's going to happen? As soon as one of those little tiny grains of sand goes into a gear of any of their machines, it's going to cause havoc. And that's what those particles can do to the human body. Now, did they finally give us the information? No, not at all. They said it was greater than 25 microns. So they said that's why we didn't even need to bother to do a inhalation study. It's perfectly safe to breathe. In fact, half of the particles are 10 microns and less. Even the EPA identifies those as extremely dangerous. How did we find that out? One of our scientists, who's a PhD in engineering and an expert in physics, was looking through the information and actually found it in the CDFA's own documents that demonstrate that half of the particles are literally 9.8 microns or smaller, less than 10 microns. So this is an example where they deliver the information as 25 microns, the other agencies take it and run with it, mostly innocently, and then the CDFA ends up with the results and is able to deliver to the public the information, the false information, that they obviously had intended.
This is Alan. I have a question, which is, I imagine many of our listeners are wondering, is this really a problem? Didn't they stop the spraying? Aren't we home free? And why do we need to worry about this? So I pose that question to you.
Thank you, Alan. It's an excellent question, and I'm really glad we're going to be talking about that today. Many scientists, many people in the public, 31 cities, 3 counties, finally the governor, who simply couldn't take the public pressure, many of our elected representatives are responsible. In fact, CBS News San Francisco, in asking the tough questions on TV when the CDFA was caught lying, finally had to stop the aerial spray over the cities. So most of us went home and thought, you know, wow, we're safe. Mm-hmm. But in fact, CDFA needs to keep coming forward with this program in order to get the money. So what they're planning now is they call it a whole box of remedies. And they don't speak of them as often because every time they speak, some of our scientists identify the inaccuracies. But what some of them are going to be the continuation of the aerial spray in rural areas. And rural is not defined. So Bonnie Doon, the hills above Scotts Valley, Ben Lomond. I mean, they simply will not define that very well for us.
And this is taxpayer money.
Absolutely taxpayer money, money that is earmarked for emergencies, real emergencies. And another thing I want to bring to your attention is to think, well, I live downtown Santa Cruz, so I'm probably safe. Well, what we found is, again, in their documents, the aerial spray drifted 3.3 miles. So under the pretense of them using the sophisticated GPS system with their airplanes and stopping the spray and then starting at 200 yards later in order to miss some of our waterways, 200 yards was of no significance. The drift was 3.3 miles. So even if they spray away from the downtown areas, it's certain, given the terrain of Santa Cruz and most of the areas in the Bay Area and much of the area in California, will all again be living in it. So they're intending aerial spray. Something that scares me personally is a thing called splat.
What's that?
Splat is a poison that they put on 3,000 poles and trees per square mile. And then
in lieu of the spraying?
This is in lieu of the spraying because, you know, generally people see airplanes and it scares them. But if they see people on the ground, you're used to seeing mail trucks, UPS trucks, all kinds of trucks. So if you see a truck driving around, just generally, you're not as scared.
It was very frightening last fall when the planes were flying. I felt like I was in a war zone. I had no idea what was going on and what the reason was for that. But more about this splat.
Exactly. And CDFA recognized that. And the new strategy is keep the planes out of sight. So they're coming in with a thing called splat. It's a poison, possibly, potentially far more dangerous than the aerial spray itself. They put it on 3,000 fixed locations per square mile, and then they put a little bit of the moth attractant, and then as the moths sense the moth attractant, they come to the poison, and it kills them instantly.
Along with butterflies and probably...
Well, many things, but I'm probably, my greatest concern is for children because the poison also leaches. They have to replace the poison every month. It doesn't disappear and go to another planet. It comes down the poles. It goes into the air. It goes into our waterways. It goes into the crawl spaces of our children. And if you think, well, what does 3,000 per square mile mean? That means that you can never get, if you actually knew where they were, on average, you could never get further than 68 feet away from 4 of these poison sources 24 hours per day, nor could any of your children.
And is this already a strategy? Is that going to be put into place, or what are the possibilities of that?
They are talking about doing this as early as this spring. In other words, this is something that they again are saying is, quote, perfectly safe, tested. One thing that I want to bring to your attention is there is a discussion, and it's a real discussion and a relevant one, about how dangerous are these pesticides compared to other pesticides. And they say these pesticides are much less toxic than other pesticides. And I'm not a chemist, and people are on both sides of that. But what I want to bring to attention of your listeners is that when we're talking about pesticides at all, we're talking about spraying them in agricultural fields. They're talking about spraying pesticides and using and applying pesticides in the living spaces of pregnant women, infant children, children in grammar school. And again, are they going to put buffer zones? No. Same as in your school. While your child is in his classroom, there will be four poison sources within 68 feet of that person, boy or girl. So, yeah, whether it's less toxic or more toxic, which is certainly an argument when we can have chemists address, the other pesticides were never used in the residential neighborhoods, in the commercial neighborhoods, in the outdoor cafes where we eat our meals.
And there's been no public outcry or knowledge of this. You're the first one that has spoken to me about this. I haven't heard anything. And most people I know aren't aware of it either, I'm sure. One moment. If anyone wants to join us in this discussion, feel free to give us a call at 427-3772 or 469-3119. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. Alan, looks like you want to jump in here.
I had a question. I believe it was in November before last November, but I was...
To 2007.
Right. But I was here during the spraying, and I stayed indoors, but I'm a bit chemically sensitive, having worked with... a lot of carpentry chemicals and certain things. But I found that none of the chemicals I've been affected by affected me in the way that the spraying did, which was very frightening. I had a complete cognitive lapses where I couldn't, for several days, I couldn't tell where I was going. You know, I'd try to go to the bathroom and end up in the kitchen, you know, that certain things were happening that were, it was clearly some kind of neurological toxin on a very profound level that I hadn't experienced with other chemical toxins. And I'm wondering if we have any knowledge, I know I read something in the paper yesterday about Obama's Environmental Protection Agency is going to continue to keep the formula secret. I don't know what that's about,
EPA.
But there is, you
new
know, I understood that they would not tell us what was in the formula.
Case.
So, my question is: do we know what was in that, and has there been any kind of discovery of what those chemicals were?
Yes, we do, and thanks again for these questions. I really appreciate it. The effects that you mentioned is quite typical. I personally am out and about quite a bit. You know, this is something that I talk to people about quite often. I'm not a medical doctor, nor am I a chemist, but I can tell you and describe what actually happened in Santa Cruz and Monterey counties. My personal experience is I've now spoken to well over 200 people that were affected. There were 643 reports of illness. I am a statistician, and I teach statistics in graduate school in the university. Based on a very simple projection of the number of people that reported and the percentage of those who reported based on those who got ill, we've projected that tens of thousands, somewhere around 40,000 to 80,000 people actually got sick. You could call it a real public health disaster in these two counties. Now, when people say, I didn't see anyone die or fall down, if the both populations of Monterey and Santa Cruz counties were to walk out into an ag field when those ag fields were sprayed with pesticides, you wouldn't see deaths there either. A large number of people would get sick, as they did, and many other people would get sick. Now, in that case, they would know why, but the far greatest majority of people in these counties who got sick had no idea because they didn't know there was a spray going on, and if any of them even had heard of it, they heard it was perfectly safe, so the association wasn't actually made. But when you get involved with this and you meet the little boy who was 11 and a half months old, perfect health, who went into respiratory arrest and was saved in the hospital, and then they sent him home. But remember, the pesticide that you know that was intended to stay in the air for 90 days, he had to return to the hospital again in respiratory arrest. And he finally, his father, a major in the Air Force studying at the Naval Postgraduate School, had to send the little boy and his out of the county to live on an Air Force base that was away from the spray. And he now very likely is going to be on medication to keep his airway open for the rest of his life, steroid medication. Oh, when you know that person, when you know Erin Alonghi, who was a tremendous 9-year-old female athlete, and now it seems that her athletic career is over. When you know school teachers that had such irritation on their skin and their breathing that they had to move out of state and start looking for work in New Mexico. When you know these people and you see the people that fought it and people whose health has gone down significantly. And then you look and when you heard the secretary of the CDFA, Secretary A.G. Kawamura say, if we even find one example of a person who got sick from this, we will stop it. And when this major in the Air Force contacted him and told him about his son, when so many hundreds other did, he has never responded to one call, never returned an email, never made a personal visit. They're completely disregarding this.
It sounds heartless. And there are ways of working around it. We were talking the other day, too, and you said that it could never be eradicated. It could just be managed. I guess a local organization, CAS, had sent some representatives to New Zealand, and they talked about their management.
That's right. New Zealand is the country that the moth came from, most likely came from, and there's plenty of LBAM in New Zealand. So the expert, probably the most renowned LBAM expert in the world regarding LBAM in California.
Light brown apple moth, for those who are wondering.
Right. Light, thank you. Thank you. That yes. LBAM becomes a word in my vocabulary.
I know.
Dr. Dan Harder, who's the executive director of the Arboretum at UCSC, he has, I believe, the largest collection of New Zealand plants in the entire state of California. And he's very familiar with LBAM. But beyond being familiar and beyond recognizing the things he was hearing didn't make sense and that nothing was scientific, he took it upon himself to go down to New Zealand for almost a full month. He talked to, again, he walked miles and miles and miles of agriculture, of forests, of residential gardens. He spoke to the top ag people, to the top scientists. He talked to the politicians. He simply came back and said, it's exactly as I thought. LBAM simply is not a problem. And LBAM cannot be eradicated. There's no reason to. But let's remember that. That's far more important. But
and that's another example of the fraud and deception.
Absolute fraud and deception. It's the basis of the fraud and deception that LBAM is a problem to, you know, it's going to devastate our ag community. But what he found just completely denied the information we had heard. Plus, you know, it's, you know what, any listener can contact any farm in New Zealand and get the same information. And what's really interesting is at the Board of Supervisors meeting in Sonoma, you know, which I attended, one of the management representatives, John Connell from the CDFA, he looked around the room, saw that Dan Harder was not there in attendance, looked at the 7 board members.
Now, who is Dan Harder?
Dan Harder, again, is the executive director of the Arboretum up at UCSC. He's the one that went to New Zealand just to confirm that this information was false and to find out if we really have a problem or a potential problem. Okay. Anyway, John Connell looked around the room, saw that Dan Harder was not in attendance. He recognized that the 7 supervisors had tremendously little information, and they, though, knew about Dan Harder's report. And they were very, you know, wondering, why in the world are we taking this action? And what he did was, he told them that Dan Harder had never visited the southern island of New Zealand when he did his report where most all of the ag is grown. And they went, oh, that's why he wrote this report. And of course, Dan Harder spent a tremendous amount of time in the southern island of New Zealand where most of the ag is. And these are the kind of direct lies that almost, and initially, it set us back because, you know, it made an impression on the public and our reps. But now, these direct lies are documented, and the credibility of, obviously, of the management of the CDFA has been lost.
And didn't the CDFA actually at one point hire a public relations firm that worked on the Nixon reelection campaign? I heard something to that effect.
Oh, yeah. Porter Novelli. They hired Porter Novelli. Porter Novelli is given credit for, they're the ones that worked for some of the biggest polluting firms in the world, and for 10 to 15 years, they kept the effects of that pollution away from the public. And they're very successful at what they do. And what's really interesting is they were hired illegally without fair competition by the CDFA. And as soon as that was discovered by a very good investigative reporter of the Monterey Herald, and she reported it to the public, coincidentally, the CDFA terminated that contract. When I say coincidentally, you know I'm being sarcastic. And when they were questioned, did they terminate because it was found out that it was an illegal contract, they said, no, it was just a coincidence. We were done with their services, even though about only less than half of the funds were expended. Now, what's unfortunate is, even though the official contract is over, the capability of the CDFA is shown more recently as much more professional. And so we recognize that people who work for the Porter Novelli or others who have the capability of taking advantage of humanity in the same fashion are still steering the strategy of the CDFA to this day.
Well, I had a question again just to follow up on the if we know what was in the spray, because I know it asked about that, and do we know what actual toxins they talk about pheromones and them being harmless? Now I know they're probably not harmless, but they're not. They certainly wouldn't have had the toxic effects that I experienced and many other people experienced. And I'm wondering
if the ingredients have been disclosed.
Yes, if the ingredients have been disclosed, or if somehow we were able to figure out what the neurotoxins would be that would have those effects.
Okay, two good questions. Let me break it up into the, quote, the pheromones, and the other, what are the ingredients? And this, by the way, let me jump. This is number four on the five methods of fraud. This is number four. It's called repetition. Just a pheromone, just a pheromone, just a pheromone, just a pheromone. It ends up that there isn't one single drop of natural moth pheromone in the entire LBAM eradication program. Not one drop. It ends up that it's a synthetic, toxic, chemical pesticide that they are spraying and plan to continue to spray. When I say this, you go, how do you know that? There have been three state reports that have been produced. Mm. One is called the Consensus Statement on Human Health Aspect of the Aerial Application of Microencapsulated Pheromones to Combat the Light Brown Apple Moth. This was done by the Department of Pesticide Regulation and OEHA, Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. It identifies the pheromone and some of the other ingredients as level 3 and level 4 toxins. Toxin level 1 is something that if you were exposed, you'd literally fall over and possibly die. You know, you'd have to wear a hazmat suit if you got anywhere near it. Level 2 is a little less. Level 3 is a little less. Level 4 is a little less. And so they said it was absolutely non-toxic, but the state reports say level 3 and level 4 toxins. The second report, again done by these same agencies, but with the addition of the California Department of Health, again demonstrated and said that it was toxic. And most recently, it's called a six-pack test. These same agencies reported that, yes, it is toxic. And what's interesting, not only is it toxic, on the tests that they did, 10% of the animals died. I believe it was 50% of the animals they tested had spots on their livers. Many of them had problems with their lungs, and it was never resolved just why. And after these tests were done, what did the CDFA say? Perfectly safe. Because how many people out there in the public actually get a hold of these tests and read them through? I mean, probably less than 1 in 100,000 people. So
for
the 37 people and scientists that read the reports and get alarmed, as long as the public hears in a soundbite that the reports are completed, and I hope that this assures you that it's perfectly safe, an expression of the CDFA, the people again are duped. And obviously, people are very busy these days and don't have the time to do the research that a handful of people take to do?
Well, who are the scientists that are conducting the studies that they're using, or are they just misrepresenting what they're learning, what the tests are?
The scientists are within these organizations, DPR, Department of Pesticide Regulation, OEHHA, Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, and the Department of Public Health, DPH. So I want to distinguish something here. We have no challenge on these scientists. It's the work they do is the work they do. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about very definitely is the management of the CDFA. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's one of the things we're calling for. I'll jump to something, then I'll come back to the
sure.
question. We're looking to try to get hearings or an investigation on the management of the CDFA, because in an investigation, the scientists whose work the managers can cherry pick, can misrepresent, can direct them to do certain things under pressure of losing their jobs, under an investigation, mm-hmm. these scientists will not come forward and perjure themselves. And it
sure.
will leave the management of the CDFA alone. You see the difference? So it's not the scientists in these organizations that are making the statements. They're simply doing the analysis. It's the CDFA that's taking the analysis and falsifying the actual implications of that analysis. To say something's non-toxic when it tests as a level 3 toxin is... it's simply inaccurate. And when someone says, well, level 3 isn't as bad as level 4, and level 4 is not as bad as level... when level 3 isn't as bad as 1 or 2, and 4 is not as bad as 3, all of you parents out there, none of you the parents out there, would ever allow their child to come close to any level of toxin. Everything they have in their environment is non-toxic.
What would be comparable for a level 3, like an ordinary toxin that we might encounter...
Again, I'm not a chemist, but I can say that if something is a level 3 toxin and it's contained in an indoor pesticide factory, there would be controls on that pesticide so that the people working in that factory would not be coming in contact with it. Hmm. Okay. And then the other question that you asked, Alan, was EPA. And refresh my memory.
Oh, yes. I read in the paper, I believe, yesterday or the day before that... fairly recently, that the Obama Environmental Protection Agency is not going to require a listing of what's in this formula for the light brown apple moth, that they're going to be able to continue keeping it secret or trade secret.
Yes, unfortunately, that's correct to date. And, of course, we're still hoping that Obama himself is not aware of this, and if he gets personally involved, that possibly he will make adjustments to this. And we always have that hope. But we're getting into the subject of a lawsuit that was filed by the Northern California Alliance against the EPA for allowing chemicals that were not allowed to be not only sprayed on people, but not allowed to be sprayed anywhere in the proximity of any food products, and that EPA did allow this and didn't stop it during the during the fraudulent eradication program of the CDA. So the suit was filed by the law firm of Steve Volker with the Northern California Alliance, and one of the main plaintiffs is Frank Egger, a 7-time mayor of Fairfax, also our own city councilman.
Tony Madrigal.
That's right, Tony Madrigal. And they filed it, and the response of the EPA and the other defendants is they've simply not responded at all to the charges. They've simply stated whether the charges are true or not. They are trying to put a gag order on this case so that the public can't know the chemicals that are being sprayed of them. And when you think about it, EPA means Environmental Protection Agency. So what they're trying to do is protect the single manufacturer of the chemical from liability rather than protecting the public from being poisoned by pesticide. And it's an incredibly surprising response mm-hmm. by the EPA. The law firm does not expect them to succeed. And one other interesting note is, by mistake, the EPA, I think about a year ago, released the list of ingredients, and the Santa Cruz Sentinel printed them. So
they already are available.
Well, they are, and many people think that's all of them. I personally, and again, I'm not a chemist, I want to make clear to your audience that, you know, where my expertise lies and where it does not. My guess would be that may have been a ploy to make people think that that's all of them and that's as bad as they are. But the very worst ones may have intentionally been deleted. And that's something that we don't yet know. But the very worst chemical is one called TMAC. And that is a chemical that is not allowed on any food products. We're not talking about the organic or conventional distinction. We're talking about any food products at all. It simply is not allowed. It causes burning and throat. It's kind of one of those things you'd see in a movie on TV when somebody gets it. I mean, it's some serious problems. Where it is allowed is it's allowed on the side of highways, and it's allowed in when you're trying to kill rodents.
And this was actually listed as an ingredient.
That is actually one of the ingredients that was listed in what was sprayed on our communities. And they continue to say, perfectly safe.
Oh, boy.
Janae, you might want to give out the number again a couple times so people can call
in. Sure. If you want to join in on the discussion here, feel free to give us a call at 427-3772 or 469-3119. And if you want to share anything as well or any questions, and again, this is Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1. And I have a quick question. I just want to get this addressed too before our time is up. What are people currently doing now to stop this unnecessary and dangerous light brown apple moth eradication program, as they would call it, the CDFA in U.S.?
Thank you. I'll talk about some of the things.
I think that's important for everyone to know, and the reclassification petition. And
back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and continue to be supported to this day, the USDA, specifically the APHIS organization within the USDA, has classified the light brown apple moth as a Class A pest. That means essentially one of the most dangerous. So the CDFA has used this classification to go ahead and support and rationalize the unnecessary eradication attempt. So recently, Sam Farr, Congressman Farr, submitted a reclassification petition to APHIS within the USDA to reconsider the classification if they would be willing to reclassify it down to a C. That's simply the end of the program. And we would be just like in New Zealand. We'd have LBAM living here, and we'd be fine. And we could go on without the poison being spread on our community. So,
when did he submit that to Congress? And have others, legislators, signed on with him?
A number of other legislators have signed on. We're there as they learn more and more about this. I believe Barbara Lee has signed on. Jackie Spears is very sympathetic to this. Jackie Spears, Representative Spears, just received a letter from the New Zealand ag community that LBAM is not a problem and that there's no reason to eradicate it. So we expect her. There's a whole list of people. I can bring it and share it with you. I can leave it here with your station. You might do tell the people on another show. And that's what we're doing and what other people are doing. What I would encourage your listeners to do is get active and go and talk to their representatives and get the list to be 100 long instead of a handful or a dozen. Something else that's being done is simply informing the public. The CDFA has tried to put them to sleep, get the public informed. Also, the EIR should be coming out in the...
Yeah, that's the Environmental...
Impact Report.
Impact Report.
Thank
Great,
you again.
Thanks.
The Environmental Impact Report, EIR, is expected to come out in March, and people are preparing to respond to an anticipated fraudulent EIR since it, too, is being prepared by the CDFA.
Also, when is that coming out in March, you think?
Well, the CDFA says it'll be out in spring. But they also said that it would be out, last year. And as the scientists keep coming up with more and more information, they keep needing to do a better job because certain things that we've already found out aren't true, they simply need to pull out of that EIR.
Now, in the EIR, why is that essential? Why do they have to?
An EIR is required by California law. It's called CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act. And when you're going to do something this drastic, you have to come up with an environmental impact report. you know, and have it reviewed by all the scientists and have a period of public comment, et cetera, et cetera. When they sprayed the people in Santa Cruz and Monterey counties, about 400,000 people, they didn't do that.
And they got around that. How?
They did it with declaring this moth as an emergency, representing that they only had a few months window of opportunity to eradicate, and coming in and spraying the people. And they caught the people off guard, and they got away with it because the EPA did not step up and stop them. Fortunately, the cities of Santa Cruz and the county of Santa Cruz and an organization in Monterey County, so it's three organizations, did take action afterwards and took them to court. And the courts had findings of no damage and stopped the program.
Now, weren't they able to spray because the labrador apple moth infestation was considered an emergency situation? Is that how they got around it?
That's
in
how
part, and that's no longer true due to the court cases?
Well, the court came up with a finding that said that discredited their claims of damage and further damage. The court actually had findings of no evidence whatsoever of any damage at all.
Due to all the work that CAS...
Due to all the work of many organizations have been involved. CAS is an organization that's been in it from the California Alliance to Stop the Spray and many, many people across the Bay Area.
These are just regular residents of Santa Cruz. Anyone can join.
Help. Obviously.
Are there websites that people should know about? Or?
Absolutely. Do you have those handy? There's stopthespray.org. There's CASS. And you can Google those. And there is HOPE and Pesticide Watch. But before we go on with that, we know about the lawsuit and the EIR ordinance. And what about the local pesticide ordinance? Can you share? I had Ruth Valdez on a couple of months ago, and she had spoken about that to make our county safe. So we have local control and decision because these decisions have been made. We've had no input whatsoever, and I believe this ordinance is a way for us to take back control over our right to clean air and water.
We're supposed to have democratic rights here.
Some brilliant people, incredibly motivated, have developed ordinances with the assistance of professional legal people that they are going to be bringing to the attention of the cities and the counties and trying to get control of pesticide application on our communities, on our schools, back into local decision-making. And that is another thing that is being done, and that needs tremendous amount of support. And as the people of Santa Cruz, of Monterey, wherever you are listening to this show, get active, find out about it. There's actually an event that I want to bring up, whether we're going in order on these things or not. This is incredibly important. Friday evening, the first day of spring, March 20th, at the Rio Theater in Santa Cruz on Soquel, is going to be an event sponsored by CAS, the California Alliance, to Stop the Spray. And they're going to have some tremendous guest speakers that will be talking about how we can keep the air clean for our families, for our children, and for our animals to breathe. And
One more question, or did you want to elaborate more on that event?
The event is currently in the planning stages. The date is confirmed. You should see some information on the sign outside the Rio. You know, the Rio is a beautiful place. It's got history. A couple other things, though, I would like to mention, besides the local ordinance, making a contribution is something you can do if you don't have time. There are people, when we talk about charity organizations that put 80 or 90% of the money they receive into the actual charity, when you make a donation to the CAS organization, literally 100% of that money goes to fighting this, 300%, because these people are putting in time around the clock. Mm-hmm. And let me give your listeners the actual phone number that they can call to contact CAS. It's 831-429-2277. And let's repeat that number at the end of the show. But
definitely,
when you call, be efficient on the phone and let them know what area of interest are you interested. Local ordinance, making a contribution, supporting the reclassification petition, providing a good media contact. You know someone that, given a story, they will definitely get that story into a print media or a TV station. How about, do you know someone or do you yourself own a property that will allow CAST to put up a large sign so that we get some traffic and people are seeing what's going on? And again, the show, the performance, not a performance really, but just a meeting and hearing about the status from really, really qualified people. Friday evening, March 20th at the Rio Theater, the first day of spring.
Is there music as part of that, or is it mainly an organizing meeting, or what kind of venue is that?
I believe they're bringing the absolute top speakers in that will be able to talk to the people about how we can best clean the air that we breathe in our actual communities, not a conceptual thing, and what people can do about it. Whether there's music or not, I don't know. We've had some very creative artists write some songs, and I imagine between the speakers, they certainly probably would have a little bit of time. These kind of events are not serious and burdening. These are very enlightening events, and if people feel wonderful in, during, and leaving these kind of events.
Oh, I've attended others in the past. It's very true.
So I had a question about the people who have left the area because they're very environmentally sensitive and did not want to risk exposure. I have one friend who actually had lived here quite a number of years, like myself, about 20 years, I believe, and moved to Vermont because of knowing that she would not be able to handle the chemical impact, having many health issues. And I wondered if you think it is safe for people to return at this point, or how you feel about the situation for people who are very sensitive.
I wish I could be definitive on that response. I do know people that were here and have moved away and have come back and have had problems, but most of those people that came back with problems came back just a few months later. I'm not familiar with any person that's come back this much later. I know people that have spent thousands of dollars on air purifiers in their house, getting the filtering system down to 1, 2, 3, and 4 microns. I hope that Santa Cruz, the air seems to feel good. The people that did get sick, many of them are still having health problems, but I really can't respond as to the people that left now well over a year if they would have any difficulty at this time. I certainly would hope not, and I wouldn't discourage them from trying to come back. I think there are other toxins in our world, and I don't think this one has the capability of making the most significant difference after nearly a year and a half. But again, I'm not speaking as an expert. I am not a chemist, and I certainly have not tested it. You mentioned earlier about some of the misrepresentations. One mm-hmm. thing that's interesting for the people in Santa Cruz and Monterey, if you happen to remember the oak moth infestation.
Oh, yeah.
At the time of when this emergency was declared, the majority of the public thought that the moths they saw with the kind of webs on the trees, and then they heard we have to get rid of it, they just went, oh yeah. Well, the oak moth and the light brown apple moth are two very different insects. They're as different as a bear and an automobile, really. And so, but what the CDFA did was they used the oak moth infestation and let the people go ahead and believe that that was the light brown apple moth. And it was in the newspaper, and people, I mean, I've talked to hundreds and hundreds of people, and other people, thousands, believe that that's the moth they were seeing, and the CDFA used that. And that's the kind of deception that
I
the report refers to.
I remember that, seeing all those moths myself, and I thought, gee, there is an infestation here.
Exactly.
And yet I didn't think it was that serious, but yes, we were inundated.
And another one is, Professor Carey is an invasive pest biologist, and he actually looked at where the moths live, how many of there are, where they're spread out. This is his life's work. He looked at it and said, you know, this moth has been here for many, many, many decades. That's how long it takes to get to this area because, you know, the female moth only moves about 100 meters in a lifetime, and the male moth moves further to find them. So that pulled the rug out on the CDFA's emergency because they were trying to pretend it had just arrived, it's going to devastate our state. So the secretary of the CDFA, A.G. Kawamura, actually went on TV on CBS News and declared that Professor James Carey is not an entomologist. And fortunately, Anna Warner of CBS News did the research, and then there was an apology, never from Secretary Kawamura, the secretary of the CDFA, but from his staff, and they represented it as he was confused. So this is actually, let me mention, this is actually the last step of the fraud. It's called... it's called damage control.
Oh,
every single time,
control.
Yeah, every single time the secretary is caught lying and delivering false information, he always says, "Oh, we need to communicate better." But when he's been confronted with this misinformation, I've attended meetings following those meetings when he has delivered the identical misinformation to new groups of audiences who are novice participants in this LBAM, because he knows that those kind of lies work on people who are misinformed.
Wow. Gwen, I am so grateful to people like yourself that have taken a lot of their time and their money to give us back, to let us know what the truth is. And the time is just amazing that it's involved in this, and I want everyone to know that they too can get involved, because it's really, we can stop this. It's not stopped yet. This is continuing. It's a continual threat. The USDA, CDFA do want to use this, our taxpayer money they've been granted, and we can stop it. It is our right. I feel that our rights are being terribly violated and we're being poisoned. And I cannot reiterate that enough. And that's why I'm having Glenn here, because he speaks so eloquently and knows the issues inside and out. I don't know anyone else that does to this extent.
One other item that might be very familiar with the audience is that the date that CDFA uses to say when the moth arrived, they continue to say it was discovered in March of 2007, when in fact Dr. Jerry Powell, a Berkeley professor and entomologist, is the one who gave them the moth. He found it in his backyard in the early summer of 2006. Now let me ask the audience, it came from New Zealand. It might have come in from a port. Of course, the cynics feel the CDFA brought it here intentionally, but let's say it really did come in legitimately at the port. If you know any statistics, none of you have probably ever had an LBAM light brown apple moth in your yard.
Never
it finally
it.
Arrived in Jerry Powell's backyard. How many years do you think it took to get there? But the CDFA continues to perpetuate the date 2007. And why do they do that? Because it leaves an impression. If it was only 2007 when it arrived, they can still leave the feeling of maybe it will damage something. When you finally realize it got into his backyard in 2006, that by James Carey's evaluation, it's been here most likely 50 years, or possibly 100 if it hasn't moved quickly. It's simply a scientific impossibility. And you mentioned eradication. The reason it cannot be eradicated is because it's too widespread. It's the same as cockroaches. We really can't eradicate cockroaches, but cockroaches are something that we really don't want to live with. Light brown apple moth is in Hawaii, where it does no damage, and people talk about the good it does regarding the weeds. It's in New Zealand, where it does no damage to the crops. It's in many places in the world, and it does no damage. But as we're nearing the end of the show, would you like me now to mention some websites?
Yes, and I, again, just want to reiterate that it's our responsibility to start looking after our own welfare, and our representatives obviously are not doing that, and we need to keep putting pressure on them and to educate ourselves.
Yeah, our representatives are so busy, and I would ask that the audience take it upon yourself to get educated on LBAM, and then when you go to the rep to ask him or ask her, then you will have more credibility and more convincing arguments, and you'll be able to do it in a shortened time.
And it seems like the CDFA and the USDA and the EPA are revolving doors between the industry and the bureaus, and they're taking care of one another.
Oh, absolutely. The UC system offered to help them evaluate this. The scientists from UC Davis, from UCSC, from UC Berkeley, letters have been written identifying that their evaluations of LBAM are completely inaccurate. And what did they do with these offers of assistance? Completely refuse the participation of the UC system. Anyway, here's some websites that your listeners can go
great.
To. The first one is lbamspray.com. That's lbamspray.com. This is a website that's been involved from the very beginning, and it's listed in chronological order. So you just read and read and read. And
is that capitals and capitals L-B-A-M?
I believe it is, but I'm pretty sure that you can get there with whether it's capitals or small letters. lbamspray.com. A second one has a funny name. It's called veganreader.com. veganreader.com. Another one is don'tspraycalifornia.com. Another one is stopthespray.org. And again, the first one I mentioned, in case you didn't have your pencil ready, is lbamspray.com.
Oh, thank you, Glenn.
And were we going to give out the phone number again? Is
yes.
That,
yeah, the phone number of CAS. And I would ask again that you, when you call them, let them know specifically what your skill is or what you want to do. So rather than taking three or four calls back and forth discussing it, they will understand exactly what you want to accomplish. And that way they can call you back with the contact for whether it be local ordinance or media connection, et cetera, et cetera. And again, their number is in Santa Cruz, 831-429-2277. And I personally want to know that many of the listeners out there are people who have participated in this and assisted us in fighting for something to protect our children, our pets, our families. And I want to thank all of you for listening today and for the work that you've been doing. This is certainly not any individual or any even handful of individuals. This has been a huge, huge community affair. And it's tremendous. It brings us energy. It doesn't take our energy. And we're certainly not pleased that the CDFA is coming at us with these threats to our families and our children. But given that they are, we are certainly going to take care of this threat and let the people know, and hopefully the people will let the representatives know. And once the pressure is that great on the CDFA, they will have to stop this.
And it has been halted temporarily because of the pressure that it's continually applied. And again, I want to thank Professor Glenn Chase from UCSC for being with us, and Alan for sharing the hosting with me. And Coral Reef has just arrived, and she's helping me out over there with the technical end. But we're going to see if our next guests are here. So in the meantime, I'm going to play some music, and if not, we're going to discuss this a bit more. And I promise you, we will have Glenn back again. So we're going to be listening to something. Let's see.
I have one other thing to say.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Glenn has some more to say.
Yeah, just remember, we talked about the fraud and deception report at the very beginning. If you've tuned in recently, just simply Google the letters CDFA. That's C for California, D for department, F as in food, A as in agriculture. Google CDFA, and you will see the report says fraud and deception, the CDFA LBAM eradication program, and you can read very quickly. Friends have said it took them only 12 minutes to read.
Yep. And it's very...
And thank you two so much for putting this show on
welcome,
today.
Glenn.
It's been a pleasure.
And it's been a pleasure listening.
Thank you.
Sharing with you. Now we're going to put some music on for you, and then we're going to bring Asher Lyons on to talk about the Indigenous Conference in Arizona. Let's see. Whoops. It looks like it's playing, but it's just not transferring. Let's see. What is it that we're going to be playing, listening to in a minute here?
Hearing a song
from Alice DiMicelli, Defend the Earth. So hopefully we will get that on the air for you right now.
Did you put that in there? Just a moment. We're trying to download some music for you from Anna DiMicelli, Protect the Earth. And let's see where it is. One moment. Do you have it in there, Alan? Oops. What do you know about this music? And Anna DiMicelli, Alan.
This is a song from a CD, If a Tree Falls.
Uh-huh.
A number of different artists. And Alice DiMicelli is a musician that is fairly well known in the alternative community. But I'm not sure, we're having a little technical problems here, so we may have to put something else on.
Do you have anything else? Ah, Coral, it looks like she's come to the rescue with some music. And I'm going to be going out to get our next guest, Asher Lyons. So, Alan, do you want to talk about this piece of music? And then I'll be right back. Thank you. And what do you have there, Coral? Oh, I always love the Wobblies. I would have been an ardent Wobbly supporter. What do you have there? Oh, let's see. Sorry. No, that doesn't look like... Any, it's still not working. Hmm. Well, pretty soon, Asher Lyons is going to be coming in, and he's going to be speaking about a large indigenous gathering. It's going to be held in Arizona, around in near Sedona, and there are going to be a number of elders from Latin America, the States, and throughout Canada, and I believe from Tibet, and they're going to be sharing a lot of elder wisdom, discussing the importance of ceremony, and... It's been an ongoing, the elder council has been ongoing for years, and there was a split, and apparently they've come together again. And I'm going to go see if they're here, just a minute. And Asher is here. Welcome, Asher. He's just arrived. Have a seat. We're going to get him set up right now. Asher Lyons, he's actually from San Francisco, and he's with the San Francisco Mime Troupe. And he's been working with Adam Yellowbird, who's going to be calling in very shortly. And he's here to speak with us a little bit now about the upcoming conference, give us a little bit of history. Asher, hi. Speak into the mic. Welcome.
Hey.
Hope you didn't have any difficulty finding us. It's
no,
good to
well,
see you again.
Yeah, I got here just in time.
You did. Thank
yeah.
you so much.
Yeah,
I hope it
bet.
Wasn't too difficult.
No, it worked out good.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, we're ready to start. You can start telling us a little bit about the gathering in April and then maybe the history and the elders that are going to be there. And
yeah, sure.
A little bit about yourself.
Sure.
Get up to the mic here.
There we go.
All right.
If you like, I could open up with a quick song.
I'd love that.
If that works for you.
In fact, we're not able to get any CDs playing here, so that would be ideal.
Yeah. I can light some of this. I don't know if you want some
sage?
Incense. Sage.
Sure. Very purifying. What are you going to be singing for us?
I thought I'd sing it's a spirit welcoming song.
Beautiful.
Call in the sacred spirit of the four directions and the four winds here, and just to give my appreciation for being here in this particular land.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And you've been in Peru recently too, weren't you?
Guatemala more recently.
Guatemala.
Yeah.
I was there. Let's just share about the Mayan elders that you met there as well.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I'll sing a quick song here just to give thanks for being here today. Thank you. Ho, hey, bam, hey, ho, hey, hey, ho. Yo, hey, bam, hey, ho, hey, hey, ho. Kaba, mi, esh, nina, mura, mana, tu. Kaba, mi, esh, nina, mura, mana, tu. Yo, hey, bam, hey, ho, hey, hey, yo. Yo, hey, bam, hey, ho, hey, hey, yo. Kaba, mi, esh, nina, mura, mana, tu. Kaba mi esh nina mura mana tu. Yo hey ban hey ho hey hey yo. Yo hey ban hey ho hey hey yo. Kaba mi esh nina mura mana tu. Kaba mi esh nina mura mana tu. Yo hey ban hey ho hey hey yo. Yo hey ban hey ho hey hey yo. Kaba mi esh nina mura mana tu. Kaba mi esh nina mura mana tu. Aho!
Aho!
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Boy, that shifts everything here.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little about that song?
Yeah, that song is a song of the four winds. It's to call in the spirit of the four winds, the four directions. And it's a good song just to open the doors up when you first arrive, or opening up of a ceremony or an event. It's a good opening song. And just giving thanks and permission to be here mm-hmm. with the ancestors here of these particular lands, and mm-hmm. To share some of these things that are coming up in these gatherings. So
I appreciate the song and the fact that you've taken the time to share this with us.
Yeah, sure. It's my pleasure to be here.
And Asher is with the Institute for Cultural Awareness, and they're going to be presenting this historical international multicultural gathering in Arizona, and it's welcoming many indigenous elders from throughout the world. And please share with us what you're doing, what you're going to be doing.
Yeah, sure. It's the gathering is going to be April 18th through 28th here in 2009, and that's northern Arizona. It'll start off near Sedona area the first several days with preliminary council meetings with the elders, and then it will move on to Hopi land, on the Hopi Reservation the last, I think, 4 or 5 days or so. And it's totally historical for that. There's never been a gathering of this proportion on the Hopi lands.
Wow.
Where they've opened it up to the people.
That I know that
it's never happened
where.
In that way.
When I was in New Mexico and Arizona, I used to live in New Mexico. It was true. They were very secretive for good reason.
Yeah.
This is unprecedented.
Yeah, they are. They're very quiet in certain ways, and they seem to keep to themselves a lot. And so it's huge that they're opening it up. They're very humble, beautiful people, the Hopi. And it's an honor to go over there and to have this gathering there. Really amazing. And they're the oldest village in North America. They're still inhabiting some of their old, what we would call ruins. They're still living out of some of these places.
Is that Old Araibi? Or
what's that?
Is that Old Araibi, the oldest inhabited location?
Old Araibi? I'm not sure. I've never heard that term. Or that is that a
it's
place?
A Hopi village, yeah.
Oh, okay. Now, there's 5 mesas there, and I've been to the first and second mesa.
Mm-hmm.
So that's... I know very little about their land, but I just know that they're beautiful people. Ruben Zeski, he's from the Eagle Clan. He's working closely with the Institute for Cultural Awareness.
And the intention, I was doing a little bit of research a couple of nights ago, was to unite and share these specific invited wisdom keepers' visions and prophesized ceremonies for peace and harmony for the Mother Earth and for all of us, which is so essential right now. And is this a vision that Adam Yellowbird has held, or many have come together and share the vision? And were there similar gatherings in the past? They're now coming together again. So it's not that new.
Yeah. There's been, this will be called the fourth of the Eagle Condor reunions. There's been 3 big ones prior. And the last one was in Peru in 2006. And there was many elders there, Incan, and the North American tribes came down, represented by Hopi Ruben Zeski of the Eagle Clan, mm-hmm. and Ukwala of the Havasupai Nation.
Mm-hmm.
They came down to represent the eagle and to be down there with the condor.
My.
And this one's kind of sprung from that, as they've come back together, and a lot of things have come back together. They've decided to put on this huge gathering.
A lot of healing took place then, too.
Yeah.
Among the many people.
Yeah. Yeah, the staff.
Coming together stronger.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Things were healed between some of the elders, and people came back together, and so they're coming together now for this amazing gathering. And there's over 75 elders and spiritual wisdom keepers coming together to share at this gathering. And they're calling it the Return of the Ancestors, which speaks of the return of the ancestors of wisdom, that wisdom is reawakening itself inside of us in this time.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming in through the wisdom keepers and the elders, and also the youth council, too. There's going to be a youth council there of at least 28 youth, different tribes and nations and cultures all around the globe.
Wow.
And so we're talking, the Eagle Condor represents the Americas, and it's the work that's been happening in the past from the Peru trip and the Guatemala trip with the Maya and the Inca, the Aymara and everyone has been really bridging work. It's bridging the Americas, and that's very much the work that's been happening with the staff being returned back to Don Alejandro.
Can you say a little bit about the staff?
Yeah, the staff is a Mayan staff, and it's over 2,000 years old. It's passed down generation to generation. And the staff was just returned back to the chief of the Maya, which is Don Alejandro.
And he's from Guatemala.
Yeah, he's from Guatemala. And the staff, there was some things that happened, and it went off to the Aymara people. And
they're from Peru?
They're from Bolivia.
Oh.
Yeah. And they might go into Peru also. I'm not sure the details. I just know of the village that's in mm-hmm. Bolivia. And the staff was returned back just last year, in 2007.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It was beautiful, and it means a lot to people that understand the staff and they understand the symbologies there. It's really important. It's, I mean, there was a huge celebration that the staff came back.
Could you say just a little bit about what that means? Because I don't think our listeners
yeah.
know.
Sure. I could share the little bit that I know.
That you can, yeah.
And then when Yellowbird calls in, he can always share more. He was there for the return of the staff, and he was there for that whole celebration.
So a question here. I'm assuming that all good-hearted people are welcome. You don't have to be indigenous blood. You could be from any tribe, white, black, red, yellow.
Yeah. Yeah, everyone's welcome to come to the gathering. You can go to the website, instituteforculturalawareness.com, and there are packages there you can look at for getting down there and the whole gathering. There's sponsorship packages to help sponsor elders to be there. We're looking to get more support for the elders and wisdom keepers to come. And all the information's on the website, so please take a look online for that.
Can you share a little bit more about the staff?
Yeah.
The significance of what that means.
Yeah. The staff was, the way the staff works, to my understanding, and this is simply from a young man's experienced understanding, so take everything with a grain of salt, because only I think the elders and the true wisdom keepers can speak on these things in a way that you might want to take word for word. But I'll do my best to share what they've shared with me. And that the staff is it's borrowed out to people for gatherings. They say it holds a lot of power and a lot of energy, and it can be used in a very healing way. Mm-hmm. It was lent out in 99 at an Eagle Condor gathering in Nambe, New Mexico. And it was to be returned back after the gathering, but it was not returned back. The power of the staff was so great that the elder who had it wanted to keep it. Uh-huh. You know, kind of like, I guess, the ring in Lord of the Rings, except the rings, the staff is can be used in many ways. And so this created a huge ripple effect, and it hurt the connection between the Maya and the Aymara, and there was just a lot of ripples that came from that, and after that, there wasn't any. They didn't schedule another Eagle Condor reunion for several years, and at the gathering in 2006 in Peru, there was a healing that took place between the elder who had the staff and Don Alejandro, the Mayan chief who was the keeper of the staff, who didn't have it at the time, and a healing took place. And they made a choice to go down during the equinox and retrieve the staff. And so in Bolivia at Tiwanaku.
Oh.
And it was returned then at Tiwanaku on that day.
What an occasion.
Yeah. And, I mean, many Incans came and were celebrating, and it was a beautiful celebration. I've seen some of the documentary footage from that. I wasn't there for that occasion.
Oh. Is there a web page that we can get more information, or just... Probably not.
I don't know how much of that is up online. Maybe on the website there's some stories about that, maybe some clips, but there's new stuff coming out every week right now.
Mm-hmm. I bet. No, the conference is, the gathering is coming up real soon.
And Yellowbird will have more information when he calls in about that too in a few minutes here.
And he'll probably be talking about the pivotal point that we're in right now, where it's so important to take action to preserve the land and to be more in harmony. Could you share a little bit more about that? Is that part of the reason behind?
Yeah, sure. Well, Britt, tremendous inspiration, from my understanding, came from the staff being returned back to the Maya people and many people. It's not just something for the Mayans to celebrate. It's really the staff, the Maya are the keeper of the staff, but the staff is really for all the people, especially of the Americas. Mm-hmm. But even bridging out to the globe, it really extends out. But it's the Eagle Condor staff, which is a continental staff, and it speaks to the healing of the continent of the North, Central, and South America. And when that staff was returned, they say it created really amazing ripple of effect of just really beautiful energy throughout the continent. And from that sprung this inspiration to put this gathering together, amongst other things too, but this was a piece of that from my understanding. So they chose to have this gathering, and Don Alejandro came to visit Yellowbird in Arizona shortly after the staff was returned, and he brought the staff with him. So the staff came to that land. And so they decided to have this gathering there in 2009. Been planning it for about, I think, 2 years, almost 2 years now.
Wow.
Yeah, maybe a year and a half.
Maybe you could say a little bit more about it. I'm going to try, if you have Adam's number, I will try him on my phone.
Sure.
And see if he can call in here. Sometimes the phones don't work that well.
Okay,
sure,
I gave him
the
phone number. I'm not sure if...
I'll just test the phones and see if he's able to call in. He should be calling in soon. So if you want to say a little bit more about that while I make the phone call.
Oh, about...
the gathering.
Oh, yeah.
What else is the schedule? What's being planned?
Right.
Great.
Yeah, there's going to be... you know, it's an opportunity. It's many elders from the continent are coming to this gathering, and it's being hosted by the Yavapai Apache and the Havasupai. That's the, and the Hopi too. That's really the nation's. It's really their land, their homeland where the gathering is being held at, and so they'll be hosting it. And many other tribes are coming. The Maya. The Inca, the Aymara, many tribes from Canada are coming. There's going to be llamas from Tibet. Japan, monks from Japan, and spiritual leaders from Africa, and spiritual leaders and... wisdom keepers from Europe, and people from all over the globe are coming, over 75, and should be amazing.
They do know the significance of this gathering.
What's that?
They really do know the significance of this gathering.
Yeah,
yeah, maybe we could mention a little bit about the history of Hopi prophecy and Tibetan prophecy, and that both those peoples came together and met together, and their prophecies matched up. I can't remember the exact details, but something to the effect that the Hopi word for sun was the same word in Tibetan for moon, and vice versa.
Interesting. You know, I haven't heard that, but what just came in just about 2 months ago, maybe less, Grandfather Martin, he's the prophecy holder of the Hopi Nation, and we went and visited him recently in Hopi land, and he's getting to the end of his days now. He's got to be somewhere in his 90s, but he's a... credible wisdom keeper. And he was, the Tibetan people came and met with him with an old tablet that the Hopis had been looking for. It was a lost tablet, and apparently had been brought to Tibet many, many years ago. I don't know, hundreds or even thousands of years ago.
This was recent.
This came in within 6 to 8 weeks.
6 to 8 weeks ago.
Yeah.
That's exciting, because I don't know if listeners are familiar with the Hopi prophecy, but there's quite an extensive prophecy the Hopi have on many things, and part of that is of a lost tablet. They have a tablet that's missing a portion. I'm not sure if that relates to that it's the missing part.
They were speaking to that. The little that I understand was that this was a lost tablet that came in, and the people of Tibet had been carrying this tablet, and so it's confirming this connection between the Hopi people and the Tibetan people from thousands of years ago. Yeah, so pretty incredible connections.
Okay, it looks like we have Adam here.
I'll be putting Adam Yellowbird on, and he's from Arizona and is instrumental in organizing the gathering. Let's get him on now. Adam?
Yes.
Okay, are you on the... Can you hear him all right?
You could,
can you hear me?
Yeah, a little more sound for Adam.
Let's see. All right, Adam. Hi. I'm Janaea, and Asher is here, and my co-host, Alan Fisher. And Asher's been sharing with us a little bit about the gathering, and you want to jump right in.
Yes, yeah, he's been telling you about the Return of the Ancestors gathering here.
Yes.
Yes, this is, first off, I'm the president of Institute for Cultural Awareness, that's who you're talking to, and we're presenting a historical multicultural gathering and sacred pilgrimage, welcoming indigenous elders and future wisdom keepers to bring the voice of the Mother Earth, to speak on behalf of preservation of Mother Earth, to bring this wisdom and knowledge forth that basically has been the riches and the gold and culture of the people for literally thousands of years now. And so this gathering will be held in northern Arizona. Throughout Arizona, it's a pilgrimage, so we'll be actually starting in Sedona, Arizona, and moving forward to the different sacred sites and national parks, state parks first, and then onward up to Flagstaff, Arizona, for an elder youth forum with the college, and then onward to the one of the wonders of the world in the Grand Canyon for sunrise ceremonies and working with the local Havasupais and indigenous nations of the Grand Canyon. And then we move over towards the Hopi Reservation for 2.5 days for the culture exchange and the ceremonials with the Hopis. And then we move back down. We come back down 2 hours south, 2.5 hours south back to conclude on the 28th at Dead Horse State Park.
Wow. And he's been explaining to me that a number of elders from around the globe are going to be there.
Right. We're looking. I've had delegates and international delegates calling in from New Zealand, Australia, Africa, Asia, Japan. I just returned back from India. India, they have some interest. We also have from Europe, the Druids, the Celtics, from Holland, all over Europe, Argentina, South America, Peru, Bolivia, Guatemala, United States, Canada, Alaska. They've just been calling in from all over, and they have much interest in attending and also being a productive part here with us. We're going on the basis, too, of we set the schedule of events on the basis of using the Mayan day lords.
Whoops.
For the Mayan calendars. So it begins on April 18th through 19th, 13th, Noch and Tichach. And we run through that sequence. If you want to learn more, we do have more information up on our schedule of events, too.
And that's on the webpage for the Institute for Cultural Awareness?
Right, www.instituteforculturalawareness.com.
All right.
And it says, too, that we are at a pivotal time in the history of humanity. And during these 11 days of ceremonies and prayers and celebrations, we'll bring forth 9 stone tablets that will be brought to this gathering for a new directive that will be set in stone by elders and youth alike, using glyphs, symbols, and word, and a set of guide stones that will shine a light on the interconnectedness of all things to inspire mankind to walk lightly on earth once more, will leave a legacy for the future generations to come. So basically we're presenting that we come together from around the world and we begin the healing of our ancestral memory. We leave the past behind. We understand what took place, but we begin working on with a clean slate, a clean tablet, a clean stone. And we begin setting that into stone for our future generations.
So that seems to me that would mean such things as healing the wounds of all the wars and colonialism and all the genocide that's happened, and being able to move on with a fresh start.
That's right. Yeah, we have to be able to get through these times with all everything that you see in the world, we have to heal the ancestral memory. There's a memory within inside of us. I've been to international and national meetings for the last 2 years, every month, and our focus has been what has happened in the past and what's going on and the problems, but we haven't been able to figure out the solutions because we're so much energy and time focusing on what's happened. Every nation, every people has been through the very much similar strife, mm-hmm. persecution, death, suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to agree that we understand and we let that go. We begin healing that memory, the ancestral memory. Then we can take the first step forward above and beyond, you know, into this next cycle or this next term, or a lot of what's being focused on is the 2012.
So
we can make it through this doorway. And this is only midpoint. This is only in the Mayan cycle. This is only part of a midpoint section in the calendar.
2012 is a midpoint?
Yeah, inside of it's even a smaller, and then we have a bigger calendar. They have bigger calendars, so we're making it a lot bigger, and the movies that are coming out now, you know, about 2012, we're feeding off the hype and the fear, but so we've got to switch that. That's what we're so used to. We've got to switch that mentality.
I absolutely agree, because I think so many of us are walking wounded, dealing with post-traumatic stress. It's used to just has common usage now.
Yeah, you got it. We're just wounded, you know. We're a wounded society, and that's all we know. So we have to be able to, we've got to let go of that. And it comes down to the memory, or the cellular memory, or the ancestral memory, or the, you know. So when we put that out, or literally set that into stone, then it begins that healing process. So this is what the gathering's calling for, is an opportunity for us to actually talk and share about this, and share the ceremony, share the song, share the prophecy, share the dance. Hmm.
So all these different tribes will be sharing their ceremonies?
Hmm. Yes, they're going to be bringing their ceremonials, their speech, their thoughts, their understanding. Yes.
And is the healing also for the earth? I spoke with Asher a little bit yesterday about earth acupuncture. I spoke a little bit about earth acupuncture.
Oh, yeah, the earth acupuncture.
Asher, and about when the elements.
Yeah, I look at ourselves as a divine instruments of light, like you would work the meridian system, acupuncturist would on the body. When we do ceremonies like this at specific sites or specific cities and specific areas, regions, working with the water or the earth, air, fire, or elements, it reconnects these systems, it reconnects these power points. And that's what we're going to be doing here. And at this gathering, we're offering an opportunity for people to participate nationally and internationally. We'd like them to register on the website to get involved, whether you can make it or not, and go and do a ceremony, candlelight vigil, a prayer, on those sacred sites or in your own home. Yes,
okay.
Very important piece to this. Not only do we do it, but it's an interconnectedness. We're working on the interconnectedness on what we call the meridian system, or the grid, or the network, or the ley line to the natural planetary system. Scientists know this. The shamans, the medicine people know this.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what we're also asking for support in this network.
And that's a key element. It really is. And who's going to be there? Can you talk a little bit about the elders?
One of the elders
on the council
is Don Alejandro, the 13th generation Mayan high priest. He has been the head of the Continental Council of Indigenous Elders and Spiritual Guides of the Americas. He's also the head of the council in Guatemala, and ceremonialist and leader at 80 years old, holding the prophecies, wisdom, and knowledge for his people. We have the president of the Ayamada, what are called to this day like the Inca, from Tiwanaku, Bolivia, that has vowed to be here with us to share their wisdom and knowledge, which is pre-Incan times, and to share their ceremonials and their fire and their wisdom and their culture. We also have the youth, a couple delegates, and the eagle, or excuse me, the condor dancers from Lake Titicaca, Puno, Peru, along with the delegates, youth that live on the island, actually on the floating reef. There's this floating island in Lake Titicaca. They would very much like to be here with us to share their culture, their songs, their language. Again, we have other delegates from the high Andes, from their culture and tradition.
We had a good time on that island, huh, Adam?
Yeah.
Sure.
The floating island together.
Yeah. It's the most incredible. If you've never been to Lake Titicaca.
I haven't.
It's one of the most incredible places in the world. You've got to go.
We took a boat over there to this floating island, and they were all celebrating, and it was this huge celebration. It became like this musical when we got there. Everyone was dancing and singing, and it was really amazing.
They were actually, I think they were having a wedding, actually. Their traditional wedding when we arrived.
Wow.
Oh, were you lucky? What an opportune time.
Yeah. So,
but there are no accidents. I mean,
no,
never are.
We're also looking at the Lakota leaders, medicine people from South Dakota. We're also looking at the elders from the Cherokee Nation. We're looking at the Cree Nation from Saskatchewan, Canada. We're looking at the prophecy keeper, William Commander from Ottawa, Canada, that holds the wampanoag belt at 95 years old. Health condition, you know, as long as it's health well, being able to make the travels. The prophecy keepers from the Northern Territories up in above Ottawa, hours north from the youth coming down. So we just had so many requests and so many calls and
it's amazing.
Of these delegates. Some of these families and people, medicine people, don't have the 9-to-5 jobs that most of us out here do.
Yes.
So our duties as the coordinators is the bridge. They call us the bridge beings to make between their world and this world through communication, to do the networking so that we can bring in the ways and means and resources so that they can join once again. And what's taking place is actually fulfillment of prophecy for humanity. So it's a very historical time for each of us, and if you look at the stories and prophecies, not only from the Americas, but if you look at them from Greenland, another representative from Greenland, from the Iceland, they're all the same. We've traveled to Asia. I just returned back from India. The Indians, the Hindus, have the same prophecy as you would find in South America or Alaska or Europe. It's the same story, just told in different language, different way, and
told to them by their ancestors.
By the Buddhas. I mean, we just spent a week with the Indians from India and 40 countries. The Tibetans, we were over there with them. I mean, the words actually got to His Holiness, the Dalai Lama and the Karmapas. We don't know who representatives or which delegates will make it or attend one or more, but they're spreading the word and the message. And with the assistance, we'll be able to manage to bring those delegates here.
So what part of the prophecy would you say is the same in that seeing a new creation coming together worldwide of building a new world?
One is we're going through a purification, major purification. It's going to look like many ways. You're seeing the reflection out in the world today through the warring, through the strife, through the relationships, men and women, husband and wife. You're going to see it in relationships in the work. You're going to see the relationships in our governments. You're going to see it in the world politics and the spiritual groups. You're going to, you know, they say we're going through this doorway. We're actually returning back to the center, becoming closer to the light, closer to our center of our galaxy. And when that cycle, we were at the furthest point, now we're moving back to a closer point. So that automatically brings more light, more vibration, more opening, more awakening. But in that process, there's all this bubbling, this turmoil, this friction, this unease. And actually, they say it's okay. This is just part of the process that we have to move through. Otherwise, we wouldn't have signed up to come here at this time. It doesn't feel comfortable, mm-hmm. but it's like a great birthing, too, the birthing of the Mother Earth. We're going through a great birthing stage. And so, you know, that's what they're sharing. And then we're going to make it through and let go of a lot of the old programming, the old way of living. And so it's a lot of surrender. That's why mm-hmm. we suggested, too, the healing of the ancestral memory and the wound there.
It is so timely. And I do feel that myself, that this is not for naught. There is a reason for this struggle and this strife, and it is a cleansing. What you're saying literally makes my heart sing at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually a great, it looks like total when it's end all be all, and, you know, then there's actually a light at the end of the tunnel.
There's a reason for this.
So part of the idea here, though, is the power of prayer really is powerful, the power of intention, when we all put it together from all these ancient ceremonies and the lineages carried down of ceremony and tradition, as well as bringing in, you know, higher consciousness.
Yes, it's very, very key here that we can... achieve, and also for this count, the fourth continent in indigenous ways, the fourth is a completion. So this is the fourth reunion, the fourth gathering of the Continental Council. There's a huge completion taking place here throughout the Americas. So it's those that have followed or worked through this might understand the process, what we're actually moving through. Yeah, it could take a few days, but I'm going to give you in a brief nutshell. The Continental Council was formed by Don Alejandro from Guatemala, the high priest of Don Alejandro, 13th generation. And in the early 80s, they had gatherings. They were starting to anoint and go to the sacred temples and sacred sites throughout the Americas, South, Central, North America. During those gatherings, they got that they were to form the first Continental Council of the Americas. The first meeting took place in Tikal and surrounding in Guatemala in 1995. That meeting took place. Then from there, they stated that they would have a meeting every 2 years. So the second Continental Council meeting gathering took place in 1997 in outside of Bogota, Colombia, in the Amazon. And that meeting took place, and there was over 500 elders that gathered in the Amazon from North, South, Central America. Then they said that for the next 2 years from there, it would go to North America, and they took the gathering to New Mexico and held another gathering there in Nombe, New Mexico, and had their conclusion. Many elders, once again, almost, I believe, 200 to 300 elders showed throughout their pilgrimage and gathering. And then it was to return. That was the third reunion, Continental Council, and the fourth was to return back to Bolivia, South America. What would happen was that it was stalled, and all of these gatherings were moved with Don Alejandro and the sacred staff that was over 2,000 years old, which has a story within itself, a Mayan staff that represents the hurricane, the movement of an intention, the movement of a people. So these gatherings were moved in the movement throughout the indigenous nations. Now, this staff was taken to South America, and it was stalled down there, and it was actually held for over 7 years in South America, and nothing was done. We did, in 2007, we did a gathering called Bridging the Americas, Reuniting the Eagle and Condor. We brought together, once again, the Maya and the Ayamada to agree that the movement will begin again and the sacred staff would return back to Central America, which the center is a very key part of the Quetzal bird, representing Central America, North America, the eagle, South America, the condor. So this movement, so in June 21st, 2007, this staff returned back to Guatemala, which began the movement throughout the Americas. Now, during the term of the staff being stalled or held in South America, we had what you saw in the political arenas. We had a president for 7 to 8 years of the Bush administration there, and the political things and everything going on in our world. Well, they said when that would return, there would be a great change that would come politically and also spiritually for the people. These are the Mayans, directly from the Mayans that we're talking about. So it has returned, and then they called for the Fourth Continental Council of Indigenous Elders and Spiritual Guides of the Americas that would be here in America in northern Arizona at this time in April 18th through 28th. Yeah, see, they knew all of this. The Mayas, they have this all written in stone. They could have told, you could sit with them, I sat with them, and all the things that we see happening, this was written in stone. I've sat with elders and wisdom keepers with about 9/11, saw all of those things written down on stone, the prophecies and what's coming. So they knew this. They knew that this cycle is, and it's also that the way that we have gone is coming to an end. I have some videos out on our websites and information and more stuff coming out too, but it's an end for a new great beginning too. So sometimes it's like birthing, it doesn't feel so good, and it's the unknown, and we don't know, you know, what to do, but I can tell you on the other side of this all, it's going to be quite a brilliant light shining on, and we just all got to keep our heads up and move on through it.
And what's so reassuring too is that so many indigenous people from all over the planet have the same visions and the same foresight.
Yes.
And they're coming together and sharing it.
Yes. Yes.
To heal ourselves, our planet.
Yeah. Yeah, this is true. So that's why we're putting all of our efforts and energy into this, and not the end-all, be-all, but it's the next step. It's another step towards bringing unification and coming togetherness and sharing. And yeah.
Let's give that website again, which is the Institute for Cultural Awareness.com, correct?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Adam, can you speak a little bit about maybe the Hopi and Grandfather Martin?
Let me see. Grandfather Martin is a prophecy keeper. He was one of the five chosen to bring out Hopi's prophecy to the... let's see, over in New Mexico, I don't remember the exact date, but to share that he's one of the last ones left of his chosen delegates that went over and shared with government officials and delegates in New Mexico, that stating we were coming to the time of purification, and this was written in stone for them, that we would either take the rough and rocky road or the straight path and road that we could plant and live in harmony with Mother Earth. So that's where also the prophecy of the purification takes place. And I believe he's in his early 90s right now, and he's just a totally incredible man, holder of the wisdom and knowledge. and that there's just so much to be preserved and held on to from these wisdom keepers, because once it goes, then it's gone. So part of our objective, too, is to sit with Grandfather Martin, mm-hmm. which we have a lot in study, the wisdom and knowledge, the prophecies that he has, and also at this gathering, you know, sit and do more transcribing and documentation with them so that we can be able to move forward. The prophecies that he shares are possibilities. They show you these things, that this is what can happen if we don't get our story straightened out. And if we do, then it will be a better road. So that it's, the prophecy isn't set, you know, the end-all, be-all. We can actually
alter it.
Yeah.
Now, we have Grandfather Martin from the Hopi, and then there's Don Alejandro from the Maya. And they're both going to be there. Is that right?
Yes.
Can you speak a little bit about the connection between the Hopi and the Maya? We were down there in Guatemala with the Hopi and Maya, and some things came up. So maybe you can share some of that.
Yeah, the Hopi, from what I understand, some of the clans that I've worked with, we took the Bluebird clan, one of the last members of the Bluebird clan, down to Guatemala, and they found their trace, their original lines, their original creation story, where they came out into this cycle of this world, which they call, I believe, the fourth world. And they found that in Guatemala, and the same story from the Guatemalans, Don Alejandro, had the same messages of their migration stories. So they actually found out just over the last year and a half that they were of the same people. They were like the brothers or the family lines of each other. So it's very phenomenal. We helped that, doing that in some of the pilgrimage that we did, I believe that was over a year and a half ago. So there's a connection between them. And what we're finding out is there's a huge connection throughout the Americas and throughout the world. We're finding out that the Ainu in, I believe that's their name, up in northern Japan, are the same as the ones up in the Northwest. So all of these, that's why we say now, Mitakuyawasan, all of our relations, we're literally in the lines or in the strands are all connected. So we're just finding our roots again in our memory. So we're holding this sacred, you know, cellular memory here.
And you were sharing a little bit about the connection with the Hopi and the Tibetan people, too, recently. Was there something else you could share right now about that?
Yeah, they have an interconnectedness, too, of their prophecies. The Hopis had that they would return back over at a certain time. It's like the brother or their relations. They have very much, I think they even found that some of their language is in similarity, their connection, their ceremonials. See, the Hopis actually, they have a saying, too, that it says that, and that they hold some of, you know, the ceremonial, some of the songs from all around the world. So they actually are actually relations. From what I'm understanding at this point, too, there's a good possibility that somewhere within each of us, we have the essence of that Hopi. And Hopi meaning the people, you know, the people of Mother Earth, or the wisdom. So it's quite interesting that we're discovering the great mysteries right now, or the mysteries that were hidden from us.
Yes, and unfortunately, we're going to have to end in a few minutes. We have another show coming on. I would love to have you on again, both you and Asher. We're on every Thursday from 3 until 5, myself and Coral Reef here.
Yes, no, it's an honor here, and I hope we can be of service in whatever way. And from this gathering in April, and we will continue forward with our other works, and hello to all the people out there, and blessings, and we hope to see you in some form or another, or connect to us nationally or internationally.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Adam. And as you so eloquently said on your webpage, we're now living in a time of our truth in an intertwined field of destiny, mending
the
circle of life. Let us look at the truth, the tree of life, the seed of life, the flower of life. The world has awaited a renewed life's plan. And this is that
and let's give those dates again. That's going to be April 18th through the 28th in Northern Arizona. And the website is instituteforculturalawareness.com.
Yes.
Asher, do you want to say something in closing?
I'll be driving down from here in California for the gathering, probably a little early to help set up. So I look forward to seeing anyone from this community out here down there. Everyone's welcome. Adam can speak a little more in closing about the invitation for the gathering.
Well, I know we're running out of time, but lots more information there. And if you need any help or assistance, please do give us a call, and we'll be there. Our production team will be there to assist you to make it all the possible and easiest to be a part.
And how can they make a contribution, Adam? You're sponsoring elders?
We have a sponsoring an elder, and we are a 501c3 organization, tax deductible for those in the United States and America that are listening, and internationally we can work with you there too. So, you can give us a call at the office, and or we have via PayPal, or there's several ways on our website. So you can support, whether it's $1, $5, $25, $100, or more.
Thank you so much, Adam. And we'll be in touch with you in the not-too-distant future and hopefully see you down in Arizona.
Yes, it'd be our honor, and we'll see eye to eye to all those that are called.
Thank you again.
Okay, blessings. Namaste, hayaya, aho, and all my relations. Have a wonderful evening.
Omatakuyasin. Right. Thank you. Aho. We've been listening to Asher Lyons and Adam Yellowbird. We've been learning about the ancient gathering that's going to be happening in the middle of April. Thank you all for listening, and now we're going to have Palestinian news. Thank you.
Welcome to Palestine.